As far as reasons why I believe, we're going to look at seven. And they're very simple ones. They're ones that you can use with other folk when you want to perhaps convince them about Jesus Christ. I know people aren't won to Christ through argument, but sometimes they have genuine questions. And if you can provide answers for them or give a reason for the hope that is within you, and then that can be helpful in some circumstances. And it's always good at least to have a reason and to know why you believe what you believe. Some people aren't too sure about that. So reason number one, why I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, reason number one is the Old Testament. I'll tell you what all the seven are going to be. We'll only look at one tonight. There's the Old Testament, there's his birth, there's his life, his miracles, his death, his resurrection, and the experience of the church. Seven lines of evidence, all of which point to Jesus Christ as being clearly the Son of God. So here's number one, which is the Old Testament. Do you have a reason for coming out this time?
Yeah, we just got the card that we were sort of way down there.
So. Okay, perhaps you'd explain that to Sonny, would you please? Thank you. I'd like you to turn, please, to Ezekiel chapter 26. Ezekiel 26. The Old Testament is a very remarkable book, an amazing book. It's written over a period of more than 1,000 years by quite a number of different writers, even a slight variation in the language in which they wrote, several different places from which they wrote, and yet it is one book, and it's a very unusual book. And one of the reasons that it's unusual is for its prophecy. And the Old Testament is regarded as being a sacred book, not only by Christians, but also by Jews and also by Muslims. The Muslims accuse the Jews of altering it a little bit, but they still regard it as a very important book, as a God-inspired book. Okay, Ezekiel 26. In the 11th year, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, because Tyre has said of Jerusalem, Ha ha! The gate to the nations is broken, and its doors have swung open to me. Now that she lies in ruins, I will prosper. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Tyre. And I will bring many nations against you like the sea casting up its waves. They will destroy the walls of Tyre and pull down her towers. I will scrape away her rubble and make her a bare rock. Out in the sea she will become a place to spread fish nets, for I have spoken, declares the sovereign Lord. She will become plunder for the nations, and the settlements on the mainland will be ravaged by the sword. Then they will know that I am the Lord. For this is what the sovereign Lord says, from the north I am going to bring against Tyre Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses and chariots, with horsemen and a great army. He will ravage your settlements on the mainland with a sword. He will set up siege works against you, build a ramp up to your walls and raise his shields against you. He will direct the blows of his battering rams against your walls and demolish your towers with his weapons. His horses will be so many that they will cover you with dust. Your walls will tremble at the noise of the war horses, wagons and chariots, when he enters your gates as men enter a city whose walls have been broken through. The hooves of his horses will trample all your streets. He will kill your people with a sword, and your strong pillars will fall to the ground. They will plunder your wealth and loot your merchandise. They will break down your walls and demolish your fine houses and throw your stones, timber, and rubble into the sea. I will put an end to your noisy songs, and the music of your harps will be heard no more. I will make you a bare rock, and you will become a place to spread fish nets. you will never be rebuilt, for I, the Lord, have spoken, declares the Sovereign Lord. Now that's a fairly detailed and very specific prophecy. And some of the details are as follows. There is defeat predicted for Tyre. Tyre, by the way, was in the land of Phoenicia, just a little way northwest on the coast, northwest of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem had fallen to Nebuchadnezzar. And this is the 11th year after the fall of Jerusalem. The fall of Jerusalem was 586 BC, so this prophecy in the 11th year was 575 BC. Quite specific. 575 BC. That's when he's making this prediction. And he predicts the defeat of Tyre. Now, Tyre had never been defeated in all its history. He also predicts that the conqueror will be Nebuchadnezzar. He also predicts that many nations will come against Tyre like waves of the sea, one after the other. He says that he's going to make her like the top of a rock or like a bare rock. He says the stones, timber, and dust are going to be put in the sea. He says that Tyre is going to become a place for the spreading of nets, and it will never again be rebuilt. Now, there are several unusual factors about such a prophecy concerning a city like Tyre, because Tyre had never in the whole of its history been conquered. It was a very easily defended city, and it had never been conquered. But the people of Tyre were pleased at the downfall of Jerusalem, and they saw in it just prosperity for themselves. Jerusalem commanded the main trade routes between Africa and Arabia and Europe. And now Jerusalem was devastated. Tyre would take over that trade and would command the routes. So she is rejoicing at the downfall of God's people in Jerusalem. This is why God makes this prediction against her through Ezekiel. Now, the city of Tyre was easily defended for this reason. It was on a little peninsula. And here's the ocean. And this is all very steep, very rugged cliffs. And there's nowhere that you can land a boat there. And the city was right here. And they had a city wall built across there. So that was the only point they had to defend, was just along that wall. They didn't need to defend the cliffs. Nobody could scale those. So all they had to do... All they had to do was to defend this wall here, and the city was safe. And they were... It had enormous walls and well-drilled troops and plenty of resources within the city to last even a two-year siege. And so the city had never been conquered. But Ezekiel predicted it would be conquered, and it was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar in the year 571, 4 years after the prediction. So that was the beginning of the fulfillment of what God had said concerning this city. But when Nebuchadnezzar conquered the city, he just devastated the walls and all the major buildings in the place. And all this area around here, there were lots of little tribes, nomadic tribes, and they were quite warlike, although they weren't strong enough to make any kind of regular warfare. But they were very bloodthirsty, and they liked to make raids on undefended villages and things like that. And once the walls of Tyre had been smashed, and the defenses were laid waste, it was then easy for these little tribes to come raiding. And they would just pour in over the broken walls on the horses, raid the city and plunder, and then ride off again into the desert. And every time they tried to rebuild the walls, they would come unexpectedly and sweep in and devastate and break down whatever rebuilding work had gone on. So there was tribe after tribe, just lots of little tribes came. That's fine, just wipe it off. just came charging in and devastating Tyre, plundering. Well, that carried on for about 240 years, right on to the year 334, which is BC, remember, which doesn't stand for British Columbia in this case, but before Christ. And 334, there was a man with a hobby of world conquest called Alexander the Great, and he was out to conquer the entire world, and he came round by land. He was from Greece, of course, was up here, round, and raided the city of Tyre. He expected immediate submission, but in those 240 intervening years, a clever little strategy had been developed, which went something like this. Just offshore, there's an island. It's kind of heart-shaped. And it's about half a mile offshore. And from there, all the way around to there, it is again cliffs. There's nowhere to land a boat. The only place you can land a boat is if you sail right in through here, and there's a fine natural harbor right there. So the merchants of Tyre that had managed to keep a little bit of wealth or make a little bit more wealth developed this strategy. As soon as the city was raided, there would be a trumpet blast, and the merchants would get up out of their beds with their jewels in bags around their necks or whatever. And they had cut some steps in the rocks down here, and they would go down into their little boats, and they would sail across here to the island. And then they would be safe, and they'd go back again when the raid was over. And they had really got that down to a fine art, and they kept little boats moored down at the bottom of the cliff. Well, when Alexander came, they were used to this strategy. And Alexander came riding up right to the cliff tops here, and he stood on his white horse looking down as the men of Tyre were going across in their little boats across to the island. And they felt safe in their little boats, and they turned round to Alexander on the top of the cliffs, and they did something like that at him. And he didn't appreciate it. He was a kind of hot-tempered man, Alexander, and he vowed within himself that he was going to get them. So he ordered his navy to go against the island and capture it. That's the greatest navy the world had ever seen, the Macedonian navy. And they sailed against here, but the only landing place, as I said, was here. And that meant you had to sail in between narrow, towering cliffs. And all the men did was they waited up on the cliffs with cauldrons of hot oil, poured it down onto the ships below, and then they dropped in red-hot cannonballs, and the whole things went up in a big sheet of flame. And so the Greek navy was repelled, and they didn't manage to land. And five times on Alexander's insistence, his navy sailed against the island, failed to take it. And he became really angry. So then he gave some other orders, and his men had to go back to the city of Tyre on the mainland and take down every building, stone by stone, and let the stones down into the ocean. And they built two columns of stones across from the mainland across to the island. And then he instructed his men to go back to the city and shovel up the rubble onto their shields and carry it down the cliffs and fill in between the two columns of stones. So they did that, with the result that all that was left of the city of Tyre was the rock foundation. Nothing, every scrap of dust, every bit of wood, every fragment of stone was taken down. And they filled in between those two columns of stone, and they made a causeway right across to the island. So the stones, timber, and dust was set in the ocean. Many nations, like waves of the sea, already had those little raiding tribes. And so there it was, and they made a causeway all the way across to the island, and they took the island. And so that happened about 240 years after the prediction. If you were to go there now, and you might decide you'd like to go to Israel for a vacation or a tour or something, and you could take in a trip to the city of Tyre, you would see the stones are still there in the water. And at low tide, they stick out pretty well out from the water. The timber and dust has long since been washed away, but the two columns of stone are still there. If you were to go there in the morning, you'd see the local fishermen, after they had finished their night's fishing, hanging up their fish nets on what was the city of Tyre. And they do it every day, right now. In addition to that, Tyre has never been rebuilt. It's become a place for the spreading of nets. It's never been rebuilt. It is a wonderful site for a city. It's easily defended. It commands a trade route. The other major characteristic of an ancient city is it's got to have a water supply. And there are fresh water springs of Ras Shamra right there, which are adequate to supply a modern major city. And the springs of water just gush out there and pour down the cliff. Nobody uses them. Jerusalem has been built countless numbers of times. Jericho, there's about seven Jerichos, one on top of the other. But Tyre's never been rebuilt. And so the prediction concerning the city of Tyre has come remarkably true. Some of it 4 years later, some of it 240 years later, some of it 2,500 years later. It's an amazing book, the Old Testament, for its fulfilled prophecy. It's also an amazing book for its health laws. Just turn, if you would, please. First to Deuteronomy. Chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 12. This is a condition: if you pay attention to these laws and are careful to follow them, then the Lord your God will keep his covenant of love with you as he swore to your forefathers. Verse 15, the Lord will keep you free from every disease. He will not inflict on you the horrible diseases you knew in Egypt, but he will inflict on them on all who hate you. Now, the horrible diseases included syphilis, which was rampant in the Canaanite tribes at that time. And it's quite obvious that God's laws of marriage, etc., and of not intermarrying with the Canaanite tribes would keep them free from that one. Then, we won't turn to it, but you note the reference, Deuteronomy 23:13. Gave them instructions of what to do when they went to the bathroom. When they went to the bathroom, they had to dig a little hole in the sand and do it there and cover it over again. And you might say, yuck, how primitive, how disgusting did I come to Bible school to learn that? Well, they didn't have the sort of facilities that we have in these days, and they didn't bother about it either in their times. And as recently as 300 or 400 years ago, people just didn't bother. If you had lived in any of the major cities of the world 300 years ago, if you'd been wealthy, you would have used a gold bucket. And after you'd used it, a servant would take it and take it to the back door, throw it out, or the contents of it, out into the street. And hopefully you would look, see if there was anybody passing before he did it. If you were not wealthy, you'd use a tin bucket and you'd empty it yourself out of your one and only door, which would be your front door. And you can imagine what the streets were like. And that was the cause, for instance, of the Great Plague of London, which decimated the population. And it's the cause of many diseases in the old cities, diseases like cholera swept Vienna and many European cities. And people didn't know about infection in those days. They really didn't. They didn't know about germs and microbes and things. And God didn't tell them. But he did give them some very simple, basic instructions. And he said, if you follow these, then you won't suffer from the diseases from which the Egyptians suffered. Now, let's look in Leviticus chapter 15. And this is the way they were to deal with cases of contagious diseases, diseases that could be passed on by contact. Leviticus 15, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when any man has a bodily discharge, the discharge is unclean. Whether it continues flowing from his body or is blocked, it will make him unclean. So it's any sort of skin disease of this type. Verse 4, any bed the man with a discharge lies on will be unclean. And anything he sits on will be unclean. Anyone who touches his bed must wash his clothes and bathe with water. He will be unclean till evening. Whoever sits on anything that the man with a discharge sat on must wash his clothes, bathe himself with water, stay unclean till evening. Whoever touches the man who has a discharge must wash his clothes and bathe with water and be unclean till evening. And anything he spits on, etc., it's very colourful. Verse 12, a clay pot that the man touches must be broken. In other words, never used again. Any wooden article, it is to be rinsed with water. When a man is cleansed from his discharge, he is to count off 7 days for his ceremonial cleansing. He must wash his clothes, bathe himself with fresh or running water, and he will be clean. Now that sounds pretty obvious and pretty simple. And if he's unclean, then he's cut off from society. And all his normal work is suspended. So even the one who's had contact with a person like this is suspended from his normal work. And therefore his day's not busy, he's got time to give attention to this cleansing ceremony. Now it seems pretty obvious to you and me, but we ought to recognize the sort of level that medicine was at that time. The most enlightened and cultured nation, apart from Israel, was Egypt. And here's an example of medicine from Egypt. If you got a wooden splinter, a little bit of wood stuck in your hand, you didn't take it, or anywhere else, you didn't take it out. It might appear obvious to you to take it out. They didn't take it out. They made a little poultice out of donkey dung and snake's teeth. And stuck that on the place, which meant pretty well certain death. You can imagine the kind of infection that set in. Now that was recommended in Egypt. And that was the most advanced culture at the time that God was saying this. If you've got an infectious disease like this, you keep apart from people. If anybody's had contact with you, they're to stay away from you. And they're to wash themselves, stay away from everyone else till the end of the day. And they're to wash their clothes. If you use an earthenware pot, it's to be broken. That's because the pots were not glazed, and there was no way they could guarantee getting really clean because they were porous. Wooden vessels, on the other hand, were not porous, and they could wash them and use them again. Now, in the year 1834, this is AD, okay, 150 years ago or so, the most advanced hospital in the world was in Vienna. There was a doctor there of the name of Semmelweis. Yes, that would be a help. Thank you. Okay. 1834, 150 years ago, most advanced hospital in the world, Vienna. A doctor there called Semmelweis. He worked in the gynecology ward, and he was a little concerned because the death rate in his ward was 93%. 93%. He began to keep some very careful statistics because he wanted to find out why this was happening. He was deeply concerned. And what he noticed was that everybody examined by the professor of surgery died. Now, the routine was this. In the morning, the professor arrived with his medical students at the hospital, and they first of all went to the mortuary. And there they examined the bodies of the patients that had died the day or the night before. And they cut them open to see where they could find what it was that had caused death. And it was good practice for the students. Then they went directly from the mortuary into the ward to examine the living patients. And thinking about this, Semmelweis had this kind of suspicion or hunch that maybe there was some connection. So he asked the professor of surgery and his students if they would mind, upon leaving the mortuary, washing their hands before they came into the ward to see the living patients. Well, this was not greeted with great enthusiasm. It was greeted with great horror and protest because it was a tremendous nuisance, and whoever had time to bother washing their hands in the middle of a day's busy work. However, he insisted, and they cooperated, and the death rate was cut from 93% to 26% in 2 months, which might strike you as being significant. However, Semmelweis continued to keep his careful records. And he noticed that if a patient was admitted to the ward with a fever, other patients in the ward would catch that fever, and that the link appeared to be that people who examined, usually the professor of surgery again, or his students, who examined the patient with a fever, and then went to look at another interesting case in the ward, that somehow they spread the fever. So he asked the professor of surgery, would he mind washing his hands after he'd examined any patient with a fever? Well, the professor of surgery had had enough, but enough. And the response to that was Semmelweis was kicked out of the hospital. He couldn't get another job in medicine anywhere in the country of Vienna, so he went back to his original country, which was Austria, and he got a job there in the hospital in Budapest for 6 months. He introduced the same practices there with the same kind of results, and ended up getting thrown out of that. He couldn't get another job in medicine, and he was admitted to a mental institution where he died in 1874. And doctors, not nasty people, not ignorant people, were spreading disease and death, trying to help people, because they ignored some very simple rules that God had spelt out more than 3,000 years earlier through Moses. The first country to introduce a law about washing your hands before you examine a patient, or after you've examined one, that is likely to be infectious was Great Britain in the year 1922. The first place anywhere to introduce a law that you must wash your hands under running water, this is for doctors, of course, and medical people, you must wash under running water after you've had contact with a patient and before you have contact with another one. First place ever to do that was the year 1960, the state of California. Moses had said the same thing more than 3,000 years earlier. And he said, if God says this, if you keep my rules, you'll not suffer from any of the diseases from which the Egyptians suffer. Also, cancer of the womb is unknown in strict Jewish families, and it's attributable to that little operation called circumcision. It prevents a man from carrying infection into his wife. And it was discovered in the 1960s that in strict Jewish families, cancer of the womb did not exist. About 30,000 American women die annually from cancer of the womb. So, it's a remarkable book for its health rules. But the Old Testament is kind of like a well-written detective novel. If you pick up a very well-written detective novel, it goes something like this. You open it up, you read page number one, somebody gets bumped off. Are you with us this evening? Good. I'll have a look at your notes afterwards. Page number one, somebody gets bumped off. By the end time you got to the end of chapter one, you think, hey, I know who did it. It's obvious. It was her husband. But when you start to read chapter two, you discover it wasn't her husband at all, because he's got an absolutely cast iron alibi and it couldn't have been him. But by the end of chapter two, you knew who it was a butler. Obviously it was a butler. Till you read chapter three, and when you read chapter three, it couldn't have been the butler, because the butler's right-handed and the crime was committed by somebody left-handed. And then as you get to the end of chapter three, you know who it was. It was that strange doctor who's just arrived on the scene, moved into the neighborhood recently. It must have been him. And you're quite convinced about that until you read chapter four and you find that the doctor is in love with a heroine. So it couldn't be him, because things must be going to work out well at the end. So it can't be that. And so it goes on chapter by chapter. Every chapter you think you know who committed the crime till you read the next chapter, and it wasn't them. And that goes on till you get to the last chapter, and by the time you get to the last chapter, you haven't a notion who did it. And you're totally confused until you read next to the last page. The last page is where the big romance comes, right? Next to the last page is where it tells you who did it. See? And when it tells you who did it, you say, oh man, of course, it is so obvious. And you can look back and there have been clues in every chapter. Right back there on page one, the whole thing fits together. And it's so obvious, but you didn't know until it told you. And the Old Testament's like that. It's a fascinating book. It's a tremendously convincing book for all kinds of reasons. I just shared a couple with you. And it's an amazing book. And yet, what's it about? You read Genesis and you find there's a seed of a woman crushing a serpent's head. What on earth is that about? Then you read Exodus and you find there's a little lamb dying and its blood being spattered around. And there are high priests and a whole priesthood with fantastic garments. What's all that about? And then there are kings, or a king that's going to rule forever. And then there's a servant who's going to suffer and be rejected, despised. And it's all sort of interesting. What on earth is it about? And they didn't know until they were given the key. Because the Old Testament, while it was written over a period of more than 1,000 years, while it was all finished by the year 400 BC, is a book about Christ. Just turn with me, please, to Luke's Gospel, chapter 24. In verse 13, Luke 24:13. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. This is two of the disciples, of course. He asked them, "What are you down discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, called Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one living in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened here in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they answered. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. What's more, it's the third day since all this took place." Verse 25. He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses," and Moses means the first 5 books of the Bible, okay, Genesis through to Deuteronomy, "beginning with Moses and all the prophets," that's all the rest of the Bible, they call it the law and the prophets, that's how they referred to it. Okay, so that means all their Bible, all the Old Testament. "Beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." And the word here translated "explained" by the NIV, I think it's "expounded" in the King James, anyway, that's what it means. Expounded. It means not that you put another meaning on something, but that you take out the meaning that is included in it and reveal it to those who haven't seen the inner meaning. And as you do that, it makes obvious good sense. That is what it means. It's bringing out the latent inner meaning. And he did that in all the scriptures. Okay? Beginning at Genesis, going right through the Old Testament, he explained to them, he opened to them the things concerning himself. The Old Testament is a book about Christ. It was all finished 400 years before he was born. What was happening 400 years ago? That would be taking us back to 1580. Well, Texas was pretty wild in 1580, wasn't it? There wasn't a Bible school here. America had not been discovered all that long, less than 100 years. And suppose we dug up a book now that was started when William the Conqueror came to England in 1066 and was finished when Columbus came to America in 1492. There was a book about you. And it had your name in it, and where you'd be born, and what you would do, and how you would die, and where you would die. Kind of unnerving, wouldn't it? Especially if, say, 30 authors had contributed to it. in different places, even different languages. That's what the Old Testament is to Christ. John's Gospel, chapter 5. Verse 39, Jesus confronting the Pharisees and the scribes. John 5:39, you diligently study the scriptures because you think that by them you possess eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me. And he was quite prepared to discuss the scriptures with the scribes and Pharisees and show that they testified about himself. Book of the Acts, chapter 17. Quickly now, please. Time is getting away from us. Acts 17. It's an important concept in terms of the proclamation of the gospel. When they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. As his custom was, underline it, this was Paul's constant technique. As his custom was, this is what he always did. Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them. He didn't appeal to their emotions. He appealed to their intellect. He reasoned with them from the scriptures, that is the Old Testament, explaining and proving that the Christ, that is the predicted Messiah, had to suffer and rise from the dead. This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Messiah of the Old Testament, he said. Now this was his constant technique. He didn't just move in and preach the gospel we preach today. You can have a free gift and have your sins forgiven, your name written in heaven, place reserved for you up there. He didn't. He proved from the scriptures that they already knew. They had the scriptures, and he proved from those scriptures that Jesus is the Messiah. Then, verse 10 of Acts 17. As soon as it was night, the brothers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. On arriving there, they went to the Jewish synagogue. It was his standard procedure. Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. They were keen to learn, but they didn't just swallow everything they were told. They checked it out against the scriptures that they knew. They already had the scriptures, and they checked out what Paul was saying against the scriptures that they had. Therefore, it says, the NIV misses that out for some reason, verse 12, therefore, many of the Jews believed. And then on into chapter 18. Verse 27. When Apollos wanted to go to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. On arriving, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed, for he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. You got that coming through? This fantastic book, the Old Testament, with its amazing health laws, with its incredible fulfilled prophecies, is a book about Christ. And the apostles took the facts of Christ that were largely known, compared them with the scriptures about Christ, which were also known, and proved that Jesus was the Christ in public debate and hostile crowds. And people who were prepared to think and check it out believed. So Jesus is the predicted Messiah. And God was saying it for more than 1,000 years that he was going to come. He's not some sudden afterthought. And of course the Jewish scriptures are not Christian scriptures, they're Jewish. Preserved not by Christians but by Jews. Passed down to our generation largely by the Jews. And it's impossible to alter something that was already written and fixed before you're born. So the Old Testament is a clear witness to Jesus Christ that he is the Messiah, the Son of God. Okay, let's pray together.